Their slogan, today Egypt, tomorrow Yemen.
Egyptians, they're proud of what they call the revolution.
So following the revolts in Tunisia and Egypt, are other regimes in real danger?
These are moments that won't be forgotten and are sure to have long-term consequences.
What you're listening to their voices from, of course, what's been in the headlines literally since the beginning of the year, as Egypt went from a despotic regime run by Hosni Mubarak to the president being expelled and all those democratic protesters in the middle of Tahrir Square, the downtown of Cairo that we saw all over the world. Well, the so-called Arab Spring, which began in Tunisia, contained itself in Egypt and has moved on, is not necessarily defined by that heroic party and the sense of Arab Spring that we saw in Egypt. It's much more about the stalemate in Syria, the stalemate in Libya that NATO is involved in, and the power vacuum that we're experiencing and that the U.S. is taking a very big role in Yemen. Joining us now is Zachary Lockman, professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and History at New York University. Professor, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
You know, we talk about the individual cases when we look at what's transforming the Middle East, but because time has gone on here, and the nation building, which has reached a bit of an impasse in Egypt even, and the very, very different situations in Libya, Syria, and Yemen, is it perhaps a distortion to call this some sort of regional revolution because things are so different country to country?
Well, there's certainly important differences. We talk about the Arab world, but of course, when we look more closely, when it comes down to brass tacks, there are important differences among these countries. I think it's still fair to talk about an Arab Spring in a very general sense. Clearly, there was a sort of contagion of a desire for democracy and uprisings that spread from country to country, and each country inspired the people in other countries. But at the same time, what happens in each individual country is very much shaped by the specific history and politics and social structure of that country. And that's why we see in different places different kinds of outcomes so far.
And I think the media gets very excited by these populist movements and these pictures in the street. But in many ways, history is on the side of the Irans or the Chinas in Tiananmen Square, or even the Burmas in Myanmar, where despite popular dissatisfaction with the government, the mechanisms exist to keep the screws tight.
Well, I think it's too early to tell, and we need a broad perspective. I'm a historian, so as far as I'm concerned, the only thing we can predict is the past. And a very short time has elapsed since the first of these uprisings in Tunisia, so it'll take years and maybe decades to fully see their consequences. So I wouldn't rush to judgment. In places like Egypt, Tunisia, we've seen a fair amount of progress towards some kind of transition. How that will play out, of course, remains to be seen and to be fought over. The case of Libya, obviously, and of Yemen and of Syria are very difficult, and the simmerings in other countries, in places like Jordan and Algeria and Morocco, are at a very different stage. So there's a tremendous desire for change. We've seen huge numbers of people in the streets. A lot of people have put their lives on the line, have lost their lives in order to effect that change. They've been more successful in some places than others, and the outcome everywhere is still, you know, very much in the air.
I know you've said, the only thing we can predict is the past, but looking forward, of Yemen, Libya, and Syria, which nation do you think is more likely to experience revolutionary change and be a fundamentally different place, say, 3-5 years from now?
Well, I am genuinely reluctant to predict anything. In each of these cases, whatever things look like now, they're not going to look like in 3 years or 5 years from now. And at best, the processes will be very uneven. I mean, even take Egypt, right? So Mubarak is gone, but much of the Mubarak regime is still there. And some Egyptians are pushing for a much more fundamental change, a much more thorough democratization of their society. But, of course, there are others, including many in the army, who want as little change as possible, even though they've tossed Mubarak overboard. So in all of these cases, there are going to be very complex factors that go into determining, you know, what changes, what doesn't change, how far things can go. There are people waiting in the wings to take over from the old dictators and make themselves into new dictators. And in some places, these movements may be crushed. Although in the long term, the desire for change, the pressure is don't go away. They will be there, and they too will have an effect. You know, even in a Saudi Arabia, the government's had to hand out tens of billions of dollars in goodies to its population to try to forestall any kind of expression of opposition to the regime.
Right.
So that has an effect too.
And a mechanism that not all the other nations can do. The Saudis, of course, you know, swimming in money.
That's
Zachary
right.
Lockman is professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and History at New York University, and we're sort of grappling with the issue of what defines this Arab Spring term that's thrown around so easily in the Middle East and by the media. Is it what happened in Egypt, or is it more the brutal situation going on in Libya, Syria, and the power vacuum in Yemen? One more general question before we go, Professor Lockman. You know, it's been the case really since the beginning of Islamic times that there's always been this intuitive concept of an Arab nation that defies particular borders. There's even a word for it, I believe. It's called the Ummah, if I'm not mistaken. And various leaders in the Middle East have evoked the idea that, you know, the natural order of things is for some Arab nation to coalesce together without any sort of borders, from North Africa all the way to the Arabian Peninsula. Is what's going on in this so-called Arab Spring really disputing that that's even a legitimate concept?
Well, I think the idea of a unified Arab nation is a pretty modern concept, actually. You can trace it back a century, but that's about it. And it's a product of the wave of nationalism which engulfed the Middle East as it engulfed many other parts of the world and created nation states. So there is a sense among people who speak Arabic of certain commonalities. The fact that today you have satellite channels like Al Jazeera and others that people are watching from the Persian Gulf to Morocco and participating in some sense in a common conversation creates a certain sense of unity. And there is a solidarity among Arab peoples. But as every Arab would tell you, there are also very important differences between Moroccans and Libyans and Egyptians and Saudis and on. And those differences are there as well.
Right.
And again, they show up in how these particular struggles are playing out.
Indeed. Well, so the conversation is global, but the politics vary from nation to nation. That's the takeaway.
Right.
Zachary Lockman is professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and History at New York University. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.